Good morning. You've tuned in to North Idaho News of the Week on Friday, July 10th. I'm Jack Peterson here on 88.5 KRFY, and I'm joined as usual by Chris Bessler. Morning, Chris.
Good morning, Jack, and how are you this beautiful morning?
It is a beautiful morning. I'm fine, festive, you know, it's a summer.
It's a summer.
It's great.
It's perfect. I jumped in the lake yesterday, and it was cool but sweet.
It is swimmable. The lake temperature. I never monitor the actual temperature. That's one that we probably should. The temperature of the water. It's just as important as the air temperature when we give the weather report when we get into summertime like this. Hey, also in the studio with us is Sansaray Mitchell, senior writer for the Sandpoint Reader.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Thanks for joining us this morning. Let's see. Here we are, and it's summertime is always busy in Sandpoint in North Idaho, isn't it? And this summer is no exception. It's been a busy week of news on the local municipal level and at other levels of our government. The pedestrian long bridge connecting Sandpoint to Sagal across Lake Ponderay is set to reopen next week.
Hooray!
I know.
Yeah.
Big news there. There's been emergency stabilization work done by the Idaho Transportation Department, and they have said that they expect the long bridge to reopen just weeks after it was closed. So that will be nice to have back in our lives, those of us who are pedestrians.
Kudos to the Idaho Transportation Department for making that a priority.
That was much quicker work than I think anybody of us were expecting. Speaking of kind of outdoor conditions, the summer is now, we are now well into July, and fire danger in Idaho's two northern counties is currently rated as moderate. In Bonner and Bounty counties, the U.S. Forest Service officials have said that there are no fire restrictions at present. Fire restrictions are a critical tool used by land management agencies to reduce the risk of unwanted human-caused wildfires, especially during periods of very high or extreme fire danger. But thanks to wet or relatively wet conditions for this time of year, we even got a little rain on, was that Wednesday morning, I think, currently, there's a low risk of at least lightning-sparked wildfire in our area. So the moderate fire danger is where we're at here in Bonner County, as well as to our north in Boundary County.
I can jump in. I'm looking at the NCWEB reporting station, and there is one fire up in the very northern part of Boundary County. It's called the Upper Smith Fire. It's at 150 acres. There's no report on how much it's contained. Other than that, there's only a couple of fires in the region. There's one over outside of Chelan that's almost 10,000 acres, but it's 50% contained now. And one down near Lewiston, it's almost 700 acres. That's 100% contained. So far, the fire map looks pretty good for us.
And we've been, I feel like we've been quite fortunate with our just the weather of June and July. I know down in Boise, there's actually a fire quite near the city, and visible from within city limits. I can't remember what that one is called, but it's they have not been as fortunate as us in the southern part of the state. In the city of Sandpoint, the Planning and Zoning Commission received an update from Community Development Director Jason Welker on the rollout of the city's paid parking program, which has been in effect since July the 1st. Jason Welker reported that 44 kiosks have been installed. There are four yet to be installed, and those are coming. There have been 2,700 permits sold overall. The breakdown there is 1,275 to county residents and 1,180 to city residents, plus 165 for boat launches, 35 for marina slip holders, and 45 for 24-hour permits, which is the that 24-hour permit grants city residents 24-hour access to the city parking lots and the in the 3 and 4 hour zones designed for people who kind of live in the downtown area. It exceeds expectations, according to Welker's reports. They were expecting to sell about 1,000 of each of the county and the city resident permits, and it has sold more than 1,000 of each so far. And they were, I should say that he was expecting that they would sell about 1,000 each in the first year. Those have only been on sale since I believe the beginning of June, and parking enforcement or the new rules went into effect at the beginning of July. Mm-hmm. Let's see. They did discuss the response that the parking enforcement implementation kind of gathered from the public, no real. Other than discussion, no real changes were made by planning and zoning or suggested by planning and zoning in response to those kind of the controversy that this parking rollout has resulted in. Further from, from planning and zoning, I think there was, they did mention that they're doing a rather soft rollout, and they will not be issuing any citations for violations until for at least another week, or that's since that announcement on the 7th. So I guess next Wednesday would be the earliest that they're expecting to start giving out tickets. They've been giving out only warnings for these past 10 days since the new parking plan went into effect. Okay. Also, in kind of parking and parking lot related news, the city council took a vote on the traffic flow for Sandpoint City Beach RV Park at their Tuesday meeting. Those of us who participated in the online survey that the city had put out were offered Concept A and Concept B, and it looks like they've actually introduced Concept C, and they're
that kind of threw me when I read that, because it's like, okay, we weighed out these other two, and but there is a third, which actually makes sense, because I think a lot of people liked parts of each of the other concepts, right?
Yeah, I believe that's correct. So they've leaned into they're favoring concept a mix between Concept C and Concept B, and that is you'll have to this is going to be better explained visually than over the air on radio, so I'm not going to try to describe the pictures, but looking at a map you can kind of see where what changes are in store for the RV park and City Beach parking lot area. They're intending to install sort of a roundabout at the entrance to the beach where people can then come off of the roundabout into either the parking lot area, the approach to like kind of the front of the beach area that near the snack shack and or the RV park area. Those three options will be spinning off of a roundabout as you enter the beach. Let's see. I didn't actually see what the vote was, if that was unanimous or not, but it was the story was mostly about just the discussion that took place. There has been a lot of community feedback. The city reached out to community members, as I said, on a survey online, and then they were at the farmers market last Saturday as well to present these options. Let's see, down in Coeur d'Alene, in just sort of human interest news, I guess, the Long Ear Record Shop is closing. That caught my eye. I suppose maybe that's of interest to nobody in this room but me. But the Long Air has been open for 40 years. And actually, they've been even successful in recent years. But I think their lease is up, and they are not renewing. So the closest vinyl record shop to any of us here in Sandpoint, or anybody in our listening radius, is closing after 4 decades. And the top story today is concerning the Lake Pendre School District, of course. Oh, I should mention one more thing. The Fair Board, Zach, after several rounds of interviews, the Bonner County Commissioners have unanimously approved the appointment of Zach Spahn to the Fair Board. The County Fair Board is now, is now fully occupied. There were vacancies.
There's still one vacancy.
Oh, there is still one vacancy.
Yes, so okay. They're still doing interviews.
Okay. Well, still one vacancy on the board, but Zach Spahn, local resident and longtime community involved person, Zach Spahn, has been appointed to the Fair Board. I should also mention we just spoke to the Panada the two board members from the Panada yesterday, and here in the room with me now is a third Panada board member. The Panada board has undergone some shakeups as well, and that's been in the news. It's covered here in an article by Ben Olson in the Reader. Chris Bessler, you've rejoined the Panada board along with Steve Garvin and Terry Pardini.
Yes, that's true.
Okay.
That was a good interview that you had with Amy and Steve yesterday? Right?
Just yesterday, yeah.
Yes. And is that available on the website?
Why, yes, it is. Okay. And yeah, I thought that was quite enlightening.
Yeah,
good.
Yeah. There's a lot of detail that was gone into in that interview. We won't recap it here, but yeah, we have three new board members, and Amy is the new president, and some questions about the safety of the building due to supposed electrical issues have been addressed. There have been three inspections of the electrical system. There aren't any big glaring safety issues. It is an old building, of course.
Yeah.
And the whole thing that kicked that controversy off was we had done an assessment of the electrical system along with other major systems in the building, and the structural integrity, which actually came out quite good. Good. The building's actually in pretty darn good shape for a 100-year-old building.
Mm-hmm.
The plumbing, HVAC, all those systems were gone through in 2023 to help us set priorities on what we need to devote our resources to renovating as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the electrical inspections came back saying, this is a 100-year-old building. There's some, you're going to want to do some upgrades. But there was never a life safety issue.
Yeah.
I encourage people to go listen to that interview you had yesterday.
Yeah, I thought it was.
It's on the website, KRFY.org, and you can find a link to hear the recording.
There you are. Now we're really getting to it, Sansare. The top story today of the week, and really of the past several weeks. I'm going to go back to last week's paper and read the headline here first, and then give an update. But the headline was that in Lake Pendre School District news, the Concerned Citizens for LPOHS Coalition, LPOHS being the Lake Pendre High School, led by former West Bonner County School District Superintendent Jackie Branham, the group lodged a formal grievance against Lake Pendre School District on June 30th. The grievance over the school district's plan to move Lake Pendre High School from its current campus on Boyer Avenue to a location on the Division Street campus that hosts Sandpoint High School and Sandpoint Middle School. The complaint also filed with the Idaho Department of Education and the U.S. Department of Education's Office of Special Education Programs demands that the district cease all relocation efforts and engage in an independent third-party forensic audit of finances and student attendance and graduation records, among other requirements. The complaint alleges violation of the Idaho Open Meeting Law and the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, as well as misallocated public funds and falsified attendance data. The Lake Pendere High School is an alternative school for students with challenges, various challenges. We can discuss what those might be, who are not finding success in the traditional education at Sandpoint High School, can instead elect to attend the alternative high school in a different campus, and they have found better success there. The update from this week's paper, and under your byline, Sansere, there was a conditional settlement offer tendered on July 6th. The coalition now asks for the vote to take place at a separate standalone public hearing. A recall of board members was suggested in the settlement as a possible consequence if the board does not reschedule this vote. And there's more to it than that, isn't there? They've also submitted a formal request to the Idaho Department of Education's chief financial officer to launch an audit into what is called PowerSchool Student Information System metadata logs and verify attendance logging compliance. The complaint, at least in my reading of the paper, has now kind of gone into they're kind of alleging misconduct more than simply demanding that they change the plan to relocate Lake Pendere High School. Well, you wrote the story here, Sansere, and you know I always like to start by asking the writer if they were surprised by this turn of events, or are you surprised at all just kind of by the tone that the coalition is taking in their approach to the school board? I'm just reading your piece. It seems that they are, it doesn't sound very friendly, I guess, is how I would put it.
Yes, I was not surprised by the action, but I was a little surprised by the tone, which it makes sense. So when it was announced that they were going to close the historic campus and move LPOHS, it got a lot of people upset. Obviously, that's an amazing building, and the students who are currently in it love it, and they have a really spectacular community there that they've formed. And a lot of people believe that that's part of being on their own campus that has this great outdoor space, that has its own separate building that is away from the regular high school. And so I knew that after that had happened and people started putting up signs and, writing letters and things like that, that they were going to file some kind of petition or grievance or something. But the additional allegations of, financial misconduct, of falsifying attendance records and basically threatening to report them to the state government and the feds, that was an interesting development because it kind of went from 0 to 100.
Mm-hmm.
And it also somewhat confused me in the sense that the reason that the school district has given for potentially shutting down the building of LPOHS is that it doesn't have enough money to maintain it and to fix it because it's 117 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a common theme in Idaho. We notoriously don't fund our public schools. And in Bonner County, of course, we see a lot of failed levies and things like that. So funding is always an issue, and it is going to be an issue for the conceivable future. And so this coalition, by threatening to report the school district to the feds, to the state, and then actually in this newest update, reporting them to the Idaho Department of Education, they are essentially threatening to take away more funding. which seems counterproductive because if they are correct and the school district's funding gets docked, then they're definitely going to close this building down because they'll have even less money than they currently do. So that was a little surprising.
Yeah. Was there a before things, you know, got formalized here, before the grievance and then the settlement offer? I mean, were there kind of any negotiations? Was there any kind of mediation or talks going on between the group of people who are in favor of maintaining LPOHS at its current location and the school board?
They had been going to school board meetings and, of course, reaching out to Dr. Becky Meyer, the superintendent, and other people in the school district, trying to get something to happen. And the idea of closing this campus comes up pretty regularly, like every 5 years or so, and it has been for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
And so even for the past couple of years, there have been, you know, sort of whisperings about it, and the students at LPOHS have been for years brainstorming ways that they could make money for their school, especially in former culinary arts teacher Rand Rosencrans's class.
Mm-hmm.
So they did tomato buckets that you could grow your own tomatoes in this sort of self-watering can. They invented this different kind of road grader that you could do by hand. They have a lot of ideas. So everyone who loves and supports the school has been trying and has been in contact with the administration trying to keep it open. But the response from the administration has basically been, you know, we can't justify the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
So there haven't really been, I would say, negotiations, because the school district hasn't really budged. And that's not necessarily their fault. Money is tight. And mm-hmm. so it's understandable, but it's deeply saddening. And I think a lot of people, especially the coalition, would have appreciated some kind of idea, some kind of back and forth about what they could do and how could they fix up the building, even if that was different fundraisers or anything like that. But we just haven't seen that.
Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, this is obviously everything's uncertain now, and we're waiting to see how the school board responds. There probably will be a meeting at some point here to discuss it. When was it decided when and by whom was it first decided to close the high school? Do you know?
It was decided in February, mm-hmm. and that's around the time it was announced. And it was decided administratively.
Yeah.
So there has never been a school board vote on actually closing this campus, which is one of the issues that the coalition has brought up.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they believe is a violation of Idaho open meeting law, because the administration has gone about eliminating the school's electives and making other major changes to LPOHS via administrative channels, or by putting those changes into bulk consent agenda items. So they are voted on by the school board, but they aren't really discussed openly, and you don't know about them unless you go and read like a 30 or a 70 page document, which most mm-hmm. people don't. And
so from the district perspective, really it's boiling down to budget, right? It mm-hmm. costs a lot more to maintain that building. Is there any kind of analysis that's been done on the cost per student for kids to attend there versus the regular high school? And this has to recognize that, you know, that school's been a lifeline for these kids that otherwise probably would be dropping out of school. A lot of those kids would probably be dropping out of school.
Absolutely. It is an amazing resource and an absolutely vital one. There hasn't been really a breakdown per student. We do know that maintaining the school grounds, paying for the separate administrators, separate teachers, versus the actual funding they get per student has, over the past 5 years, cost the school district $500,000. And so the issue really is that, especially next year, when they only have 56 students enrolled, because the state doles out school funding via, it's determined by how many students you have, what their attendance is, and then the student-to-teacher ratio. And so the alternative school just really doesn't qualify for very much funding. It qualifies for additional separate funding for at-risk students. And so, as Jack said earlier, anyone who attends LPOHS has to be an at-risk student determined by state standards. So that's someone who is in danger of flunking out, who has failed multiple classes, who has a substance abuse problem, who has faced trauma in their life. It can really be a lot of things. I know when I went to Sandpoint High School and I knew kids at LPOHS, they were kids who had been abandoned by their parents, who were raising their little siblings, who were working a full-time job at the same time. And the school tailors everything to meet their needs and ensure that they still graduate and that they have a really a great education and a very practical, hands-on education, which is better for alternative learners. So,
mm-hmm. So as it stands, the school board's intending to meet on Tuesday, right? The July 14th, and not have the separate meeting that's being requested.
Yes. So when I reached out to the school district to see if they were going to abide by the coalition's demands. So again, the coalition initially requested that they have a hearing and also a vote at the upcoming meeting on July 14th. That's just the regular school board meeting. And the school district said, okay, we will have a vote out in the open on that day. And then the coalition came back and said, well, actually, we'd rather you have that meeting in or have that vote in a public hearing, which allows for more time per speaker in terms of public comment. Mm. And so they threatened to launch a recall of the school board members who didn't comply with that. And when we reached out to the school district last week while I was writing this, they said that they still plan to go ahead with the vote on Tuesday, the 14th. However, I was talking to the community liaison director, and she could not get in contact with the superintendent or the vice superintendent. So it's unclear if maybe they're going to allow additional public comments at that meeting, or if they'll kind of turn that regularly scheduled meeting into a hearing, mm-hmm. To kind of comply with the demands in that way. Hmm. So we haven't heard an update on that yet.
Okay. So the big update is coming in 4 days at the Tuesday, July 14th. Hearing. That's the next time we'll go. That could determine the future of Lake Pontarie High School, I guess, that meeting.
Yes. And mm-hmm. I imagine if I had to put on my crystal ball and my future seeing goggles, mm-hmm. that the school board is still going to vote to close the building. Honestly, the only path forward that I could imagine is one of the big issues that people are drawing on is that they don't want this school moved to the portables behind Sandpoint Middle School. Yeah. Because it is really close to Sandpoint High School. It feels like it's just kind of enmeshing all of the schools and that they're not their own separate campus. So the the only path forward I could see was finding an alternative place for the campus, which has been brought up multiple times, but nobody's had any really viable ideas so far. And even if that were to happen, Lake Pendere High School would still not have any electives or teachers, no PE, no culinary arts, no art.
Don't they take a bus now to the high school for some of those electives?
Yes. Yeah. So even if we move the campus, they're still going to have to walk or bus to SHS or take those classes online. And with alternative learners, they really need a hands-on teacher who's inspiring and helping them. And so there's a lot of talk that if these kids either have to go back to Sandpoint High School, a place that they were potentially traumatized in, that they had to leave, or they have to go online and monitor themselves, that they're really just not going to do the schoolwork and they're going to drop out, which they're already at risk of doing. So the grievance makes a lot of good points in that sense, and it really is coming from a good place, trying to protect our most vulnerable kids. But it is also doing a lot of other things and making a lot of other allegations.
Yeah. Have you seen, like, a figure? Has a figure, a monetary figure, ever been presented? You know, what would it take, either as a one-time, you know, maintenance fee, or what would it take as an ongoing figure to keep Lake Pendere High School open in its current location? Like, how much work does the building need, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Millions of dollars worth is the number that I've heard of. Yeah,
they haven't released an official number because they haven't, you know, gone out to bid for all the work, but they need to reinforce the masonry. They need to replace the roof, install ADA compliant access and emergency exits. They need to replace the plumbing, install new fire suppression, replace the fire alarm system. It's a massive overhaul. And it's not the worst rated school in the district, which is something else the coalition has touched on. You know, why are we closing this school and not the buildings that got a worse safety rating? And to be clear, they're all still safe. It's just a worse rating. But of course, the issue is those other school buildings that were ranked lower still have way more students and therefore get way more funding. And so it makes financially more sense to update those buildings, like the Sandpoint Middle School, which is currently, it was ranked lower and now it is undergoing renovations. And will be this.
A big renovation there.
Big renovations, yes. And it'll be all summer.
And some additions, too, yeah.
I mean, I guess one final thing here is, I mean, the Lake Pendere School Board, the school district is a taxing district. They could potentially, I mean, if determine a figure and put an issue on the ballot even this November, if they wanted to, for voters to determine, you know, whether to fund Lake Pendere High School or not. Could it not be put to the voters rather than just determined administratively or by the school board?
It absolutely could. And I imagine the reason that they haven't requested a levy for this building is probably because they're going to request levies in the future for other buildings. And they know that we don't pass levies historically. And so they really have to pick and choose when they ask for money, because it's, you know, it's a very small chance that they're actually going to get it. So it was pretty remarkable when the funding for Sandpoint Middle School's renovations and expansion came through. But if the coalition keeps pushing, if there is enough, you know, public input and outcry for this building, then maybe they will go ahead with it.
Yeah. Well, they would have an energized base to go out and advocate for it.
Right. Yeah. That seems like that's oftentimes what's missing when the school board puts out these levy options. Yeah. Hey, you know what? it's past our time as usual. We got to leave it there, I think, unless, Sansari, did I leave anything out? Is there any final wisdom you can share with us on this story?
I will say go look, if you didn't go to the 4th of July parade, go look at the Sandpoint Reader article or just go scroll through Facebook because they made an LPOHS float.
Yeah.
And it was incredible.
It was probably, unfortunately,
came at the very end of the parade. I was like, you should have moved it up because it was probably the most impressive float out there. It was a depiction of the building itself. Big, very big, like 20 feet long and 10 feet tall. It was,
it was incredible.
Yeah.
Well, yes, we have a new show here on 88.5 KRFY, a brand new program, and it's called North Idaho Climate News. And it's going to air on a monthly basis following North Idaho News of the Week. So it won't be every Friday, but it will be this Friday. We have the very first episode of North Idaho Climate News coming up next. Listeners, let us know what you think about this. It's hosted by Brad Huta. How about that? Yeah, local resident and an interested person in the climate and what's going on out there. His first episode is an interview with Diane Green of Green Tree Naturals, just about how things have changed for their business, which I think is, well, you'll hear where it's located. Chris Sansare, that's it, I guess.
All right.
Good morning.
Happy Friday,
everyone.
Thank you.
That affects North Idaho weather, lifestyle, and livelihoods. I'm Brad Huta, and this is KRFY 88.5 FM. Today I'm 0.4 miles past the Pack River store on Rapid Lightning Road at Green Tree Naturals Organic Farm talking with Diane Green. Thanks for having me come out, Diane.
Thanks. Good morning.
So let's start just with basics. How long have you been here on your farm?
Over 30 years.
30 years.
Yeah. My husband, Tom, and I have been cultivating a small acreage certified organic farm here for over 3 decades. And we're one of the oldest certified organic farms in the region. We certified the first year that it became available.
So all organic, that means no chemicals?
Organic means no pesticides, no herbicides, no chemical fertilizers. And a lot of by hand work and good, clean, safe food, working with nature, working with the environment.
All right. So what all do you grow here?
We grow over 130 different varieties of certified organic vegetables, herbs, flowers, grapes, a couple different kinds of grapes, 9 kinds of garlic, 4 kinds of hops. My husband makes his own organic beer. And we grow garden seeds and berries. We started growing seeds, open pollinated seed stock for Snake River Seed Cooperative located in Boise a few years back. And so seeds and a little bit of everything.
So over that 30 years and with that diversity of crops, have you noticed any crops that have done better over that time or that you've had to phase out because of changes in weather patterns or changes in pollination or just whatever changes you've noticed during that time?
Change is the only constant with growing a garden here or having a small acreage farm. A lot of things that we could never grow before, like okra. I mean, I grew up in Oklahoma, and my husband's been trying to grow okra for me forever, which he's tried it in the greenhouse, in the hoop house, outside, using all kinds of season extension techniques. And last year, for the first time, after 30 years of trying, he got an okra crop. He's so proud of himself.
Wow.
But, you know, that was last year. Who knows what this year will bring? But It's consistently inconsistent. You know, there's times where we used to, when we were growing for the restaurants, our target was to grow and harvest 35 pounds of salad mix a week for that. And we would put shade cloth on it. And now, I mean, we used to do like 30% shade cloth. Now it needs like 60% shade cloth because it's so much warmer. And in using season extension techniques, like for tomatoes over the years, we would always do black weed mat to heat up the soil. You know, when you wear black, it's warmer, and tomatoes like warm roots. But then as things have been warming up, we found that it was made it too warm for tomatoes, and I ended up having to go out and I bought a bunch of white sheets and cut them in strips and put on top of it to make it cooler on top of the black once the tomatoes got going, because tomato pollen becomes infertile over 92-94 degrees, and then you don't get any tomatoes. So first it was too cold, and then it was too hot, and it's the variable of hot cold is just, that's the closest thing to normal that we have anymore. And really there is no normal. I mean, for years we would always have our first frost of the season in mid-September, and now it's not unusual for us to be able to grow into October. And as far as in the springtime, we still hold true to Memorial Weekend as the last frost date, although it's warmer earlier and it's possible to get out there, but then there's a frost. And we did have a frost right around Memorial this year, so.
Yeah, so it sounds like what you're saying is you've noticed some warming trend, but still extremes of hot and cold.
Oh, yeah. It's variable. I mean, there's no normal. I mean, there really isn't. I mean, I tell my gardening students, always plan for the hottest, coldest, wettest, driest weather on record, and you're ready to grow in North Idaho. And that's the only way we can continue growing a successful garden, is to be prepared for anything. I think last year a lot of people got frosted right around the 4th of July, and we're going into a cold spell.
This weekend's supposed to be chilly.
Right. So higher elevations might be getting a frost.
What then can gardeners do if they have a late frost?
Frost cloth. I mean, everybody that's growing in the northern regions need to have some kind of frost cloth on hand and be prepared to cover whatever you have that can't take a frost, which is, you know, the heat-loving crops like tomatoes and peppers and eggplant, cucumbers, summer squash, winter squash. They're very sensitive to a cold snap.
Okay.
Basil certainly doesn't like it. Basil doesn't like it below 50. One of the things we do is saving our own seeds, and we've done that for years, and that's one of the reasons why we started growing some seed for the seed cooperative. And we have a melon. Tom, my husband, loves cantaloupes, and we just tried with different varieties and could not get a successful ripe, vine-ripened melon. And once you've tasted a vine-ripened melon compared to what you eat in the store, just like with a tomato in the store versus a vine-ripened tomato, there's nothing like it. And by saving seed for 10, 15 years, we now have a melon that matures and ripens. And I love it when melon season is on at the farm stand, because people come and everyone says it's the best they've ever had. And it's because they've never tasted a vine-ripened melon. They've only tasted what's been picked 10 days ago to ship across the country.
So over time, I assume by saving seeds, you pick those melons that have done the best out of each year, each crop. And so whatever changes have been introduced into those, that plant is passed on to the next generation through the seeds. So it's kind of like evolution in real life. And that gradually you're selecting out those melons that are going to be most successful in this climate.
Absolutely. And the same with tomatoes. We have two different varieties of tomatoes that we've been saving seed from for 20 years. And now we have 1 pound tomatoes that when you slice them, there's no air pockets in there. They're just solid meat, and they taste like a fine ripened tomato because we harvest them when they're ripe on the vine. What a novelty. And you know, it's the same. You brought me some strawberries this morning, which was a wonderful gift. And the strawberries in the store, yeah, they don't taste like anything. They're because they're picked when they're not ripe.
Yeah, they ripen in the carton.
Right. So,
I think I've seen something like that with those seeds, because when I first came here 10 years ago, I got some seeds for peas, snap peas from you. And over time, I've continued those. And at one point, we found some of those seeds that resisted powdery mildew. And so we've kept those. And this year, I just took 6.5 pounds of peas to the food bank.
Oh, good for you.
And they're incredible. Even as they get big, the pods remain crunchy, and they don't get that fibrous change until they're way late in development.
Right.
And so you can eat them even as they get bigger and bigger and fill with peas. They're still delicious, and you can eat the whole thing. And it's amazing to see those changes over time. So that... As we adapt to that, perhaps that's one way that nature adapts to when there are changes in the climate and the weather patterns.
Sure. I mean, we have a snow pea that we've been saving seed from for 22 years that we grow for the seed co-op, and we call it summer snow. Mm. When we first started growing that 22 years ago, the snow peas we'd be done harvesting them by about now, the end of June. And over time, I would watch the plants and flag the plants that were the last ones flowering, the last ones making maturity.
Right.
And kept saving those and saving those and saving those. And now our summer snow pea, we will be harvesting it into August.
Wow, that's phenomenal for a cold-loving crop.
You know, nature has the ability to adapt to change, and so must we. And I really feel like observing nature and paying attention to what's going on around me in the gardens, in the field, really helped me to adapt to the changes that are happening with the climate.
Yeah, well, that's very hopeful, because I just read an article about potential decreased productivity for soybean, corn, and cotton in the states in the Midwest that grow those primarily. And this article looked at the last 70 years correlating crop productivity by acre for each county across the United States, and correlated that with temperature records. And what they found with temps over 90, 92 degrees, that productivity started to decrease dramatically. And so their prediction by the end of the century is that we could see decreases in productivity anywhere from 20 to 80% of soybean and corn based on these past records. If that happens, that's going to be an agricultural disaster and a real food issue. But what you're saying is that potentially there's going to be some adaptations available in those crops where we don't see that productivity loss.
Well, we have to hold on to hope with that. But also, when we look at conventional agriculture versus organic agriculture, conventional agriculture is based on chemical fertilizers, which feed the plants, not the soil. They're based on herbicides and pesticides. The pesticides are killing the pollinators. The herbicides are killing the natural bacteria and mycelium in the soil. So if you compare, and I'm sure there's studies done on that, organic agriculture versus conventional agriculture, the difference is with organic agriculture, it's all about feeding the soil. Everything is about feeding the soil. So I, in what you're talking about and this happening in commodity foods, if some shifts were happening in building the soil, and part of feeding the soil and building the soil is increasing nutrients in the soil, and I mean the difference of yields of organic versus conventional depends on what it is, but in a lot of cases it's considerably different. And I for one, being a great advocate of organic agriculture and organic gardening, believe that we can make a difference, and that we just need to be thinking of how we grow more sustainably, and growing organically can make a difference.
I want to remind our listeners that you're listening to North Idaho Climate News on KRFY 88.5. This is Brad Hewden. I'm talking with Diane Green of Green Tree Naturals. Back to that point of feeding the soil, I guess another advantage of organic methods is you increase the organic matter in the soil, which increases soil moisture retention.
Absolutely.
And a big issue with the temperature increase is going to be drought. That at the beginning of March, 60% of the United States were in drought condition, and that is probably going to be worsening, especially with March being the hottest month on record for many states in the Southwest. And that actually included Idaho. We don't notice it as much because we didn't have those extremes of 110, 120 degrees that they did in the Southwest. But Idaho is warming also.
Well, I certainly notice a difference when I'm out in the field every day.
So, so in addition to, you mentioned for heat protection, putting on shade cloth. That seems counterintuitive to me, because if you block the sunlight, that may cool it down, but won't that inhibit growth?
Well, it depends on what kind of shade cloth you use, but I mean, certainly in a field situation on a larger scale farm, shade cloth isn't possible, but for a home gardener and a small acreage farmer, a lot of us use shade cloth. Like, we, for season extension, we're using hoop houses, and we have a high tunnel and a greenhouse, and we put shade cloth on those because it gets too hot in there. We never had that problem in the past, you know, 30 years ago, but now it is too hot. So shade cloth comes in, it's threads per inch, how closely together the web of the shade cloth is, and we use like a 40 to 60% shade cloth, and it doesn't seem to make a difference. The cooling is more important than the sun. It's not completely blocking out the light, so that's still happening.
But. And so you're using that on established plants that have already started growing and producing, and this is in the heat of the summer, when we need to cool them down.
Right. We're talking 90 degrees plus.
Okay, 90 degrees plus.
But also, you know, for like, we're still planting. It's the end of June, and we've almost got everything in. But, you know, planting when you're in your 70s is a lot different when we start doing this in our 30s, so everything takes longer than it used to. So a lot of things, like I planted, transplanted some lettuce yesterday, and I put shade cloth over it, just to keep it cool until the roots get well established, and then I'll take the shade cloth off.
So. Okay. All right. So that's a good strategy for our gardeners. Have you noticed with the changes, any changes in insects in terms of pollination or in terms of pests that you may be dealing with?
I'll share. The warmer climate brings new pests, and but it also brings new beneficial insects. And we used to, for years, we would buy praying mantis egg cases and release them and never saw a praying mantis, or maybe we'd see one here and there. And the last few years, as it's been warming up, we see lots of them, like hundreds of them.
And so those are a beneficial insect.
They eat grasshoppers and beetles and moths and crickets. I mean, yeah, they're predatory insects that really make a difference. As far as the bees go, I can't say that I've noticed maybe some difference with some of the pollinator species. We have a lot of bumblebees here, a lot of mason bees. We do have a gentleman that brings 28 honeybee hives here every summer, and that is wonderful for pollination here. And I had, when he first started bringing the honeybees here, I was a little concerned about them competing with the native bee species for pollination, but it doesn't seem like it's been a problem. They seem to
plenty for everybody.
Cohabitate just fine. But I think it really depends on where you are. We're pretty isolated. We've got trees all around the garden area, so it's not a chance of like a neighbor spraying herbicides or pesticides that are going to contaminate our bee and pollinator population here. Where if you were out in an open area with farms around you or neighbors near you where that are doing herbicides and pesticides and inevitably doing that on a windy day, it's going to be impacting. But ideally, planning the garden for attracting pollinators is really something that we've always done by trying to have something flowering all the time and having flowers throughout the vegetable garden, which encourages the pollinators to come. And you know, you want to create a habitat for them where they want to stay, raise their children and generations of children, because that's pretty important.
So it sounds like your orientation is very much working with the changes of nature as opposed to trying to fight it or control it.
Well, we can't control it. We can only do our best to make clear observations and work with nature in a partnership that benefits both of us. I can say that growing here for over 30 years, every single year I find myself saying, huh, that's never happened before, about something. And I find the more I know, the more I know I don't know. You know, it's because it's changing all the time. I can't say it's always this way, other than it's always changing.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to adjust to that, because you can't just keep doing things the same way and expect things to change. So we observe nature and do what we can to adapt and work with what we have, and do it sustainably.
Yes, yes, that's good. So one other thing that may be occurring as we have increasing temperatures is more problems with drought. This year, they've called that a El Nino phenomenon has occurred with heating in the Pacific, and I find it a little hard to find good predictions of how that's going to affect us here in Idaho, though I have read some things suggesting that it may cause more drought. If that happens, what measures can people take to protect their gardens?
Well, I think making a commitment to a garden organically really gives us a way of practicing conservation in our own backyards, gives us an opportunity to be good land stewards, and doing what we can to, mulching is huge for holding the soil moisture in, and mulching, building soil. I mean, organic matter in the soil also holds moisture to it, so that's something that you kind of have to do before you start growing.
So by mulching, you mean taking organic material like leaves and grass clippings and working them into the soil or spreading them over the top of the soil.
Right, right. Nature produces large quantities of mulch all the time with fallen leaves and needles and twigs and pieces of bark, fallen fruit, other organic materials. Nature does that. So just in observing nature, nature tells us what to do. We just need to work with that. So we use, we mulch with compost, with aged straw, with grass cuttings, leaves, I mean, anything we can, we get a good mulch in there, and it makes a considerable difference of the soil temperature and the moisture.
Okay. One caution on that to our listeners, be careful where you get your organic material, because if you get your grass clippings from your neighbor who has sprayed his lawn with an herbicide, that herbicide is going to kill all the plants that you're trying to mulch.
Absolutely. You got to be very selective with where you get your grass.
Okay. Any other thoughts or comments about our changing climate and how that's going to change what you and your husband do here on your farm?
Well, I think, you know, for us, our motto is do what you can, where you can, when you can. And that's, I think, looking at being good land stewards and taking care of what we have gives me hope. When I look at the big picture of what's going on, the one thing I can control is my little piece of paradise right here. And whether you have a few boxes that you're growing vegetables in, or a half acre garden, or 10 acres, you can be a good land steward and take care of the land in a way that is not detrimental. We have to do what we can to preserve agricultural land, to preserve the soil, and be able to continue growing food for our communities, for ourselves. So I think that's really important.
Thanks, Diane. You've been listening to North Idaho Climate News on 88.5 KRFY. If you're concerned about changes in the climate, make some noise. Contact your senators and congressmen in Washington, D.C. Let them know that climate change is not a hoax. That we're seeing changes happening. It sounds like here in North Idaho, the main change that we see is more change. Things are warming up, but that there are potential ways that we can adapt to that and even thrive in that. Another suggestion in terms of a change to make would be to stop driving so much and get a bicycle. Thanks for listening, and tune in next time.